morning, honorable members. Our visitors from Tubelisha, I understand that there's also KPMG and the other guests. PMG, what is this? Parliamentary monitoring, yeah. Yeah. And then the other guests. This morning I would like to welcome you to this meeting, which has been structured for Tubelisha to present the closure plan. As we all are aware that Tubelisha has been the implementing agent of the department in the provision of there were two, in fact, mandates. If I'm not, I'm subject to correction. There was an initial mandate that was provided by the Department of the National Department of Housing, and as time went on, they were also given additional responsibility. So we would like to hear at this stage, as they are about to wind up, what is their plan, how far have they gone, and more especially, as the portfolio committee, we are interested on the future of the employees. We have been saying that we are the caring government. So more especially at this stage of this economic turndown, we are keen to know what is the status. And we were driving this process as from the time the minister announced that there's going to be this winding up. As the portfolio committee, we're very much concerned about the future of the employees. And there were commitments that were made by the office of the minister. So I think today, because I think this is the last meeting we are going to have with Tubelisha. Hence, we have been advised that the closing date is on the 31st of July. So we are very much concerned to know what is going on after this. So with those few words, I wish to welcome everybody to this meeting. The agenda, in fact, our agenda in front of us, we are supposed to start with the minutes, but I think we can do that after the presentation. I'm going to request my committee members that we do it at the last, because we are still having a sitting at 12. So we need to complete this process. And I would urge Tubelisha to try, by all means, to stick on the time. And I don't mean that they must leave the stone unturned, but they must try to be short and sweet. Thank you. You are welcome, Mr. Gandhi. Thank you very much. I understand that the refreshments were not there when we get in. I'm just giving you the opportunity to come and pick up a cup of tea, and then you come to your, it's going to be a working tea. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm
warning you. I'm warning you. I'm warning you. I'm warning
you. I'm just going.
So no more whiskers, eh? Whiskers out the window. I just wanted to fall pregnant again. Okay, what is it? I was very spoiled then, eh?
I'm going to have a baby, anyway.
Next year.
Is it?
We are going to sit. Let's keep it outside.
I never heard from those people.
No one here, but I think someone is. Someone is sitting in all these chairs at this moment.
And here? You can see that the Yama family. She called to me.
Yeah, it is. They really underestimated the number.
Yeah.
That is a man of youth, what you're doing now. Am I right?
That's
a man of youth.
What does this mean?
Okay, can I help myself?
What's always? And so we are going to mess up.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. Somebody was sitting here. There's something here.
Somebody was. We are very.
recording.
Oh, it's recording. Oh, okay. Mm. As long as it's not recording me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't look sorry. You must be serious when you say sorry. But you're not serious. But you are now sexy, not serious. Look at her. She's getting sexy. She's laughing. Guys, please, I'm married. Yeah? Actually, incoming to property. Now you can sign there, it's not a problem. Not, you can just jump over. We can't, the house is too crowded.
We were about to get a presentation from Tubelisa. Over to you, Tubelisa.
Good morning, Madam Chair, honorable members. My name is Manuel Pillay, acting COO of Tubelisa. What I'd like to kick off with is just an overview of what our standard mandate is. But just before doing that, I just want to give you a view about what the original mandate was. If you're going to get my first slide, you'll see that Tubelisa was established as the Section 21 company in 1997 and started actual operations in January 1999. And the sole purpose of that special purpose vehicle was basically to procure housing stock in line with Servcon's right-sizing program. Now, I would imagine a number of people around here know what the right-sizing program was all about. If not, I can expand on that a little bit, although it's historical stuff and really isn't pertinent to today's discussion.
I think just briefly, but not get into details, because unfortunately we have got 100% new members. So they have to follow up the discussions as they come, but you must not get into details.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Madam Chair. Right-sizing effectively relates to a program that government embarked on. And in August of 1997, people who had defaulted on their bond repayments, total households totaling 33,000 countrywide, was ring-fenced. And Servcon were supposed to, they had representation by the banks on their boards, and Tbilisi were established basically to supply housing to the 33,000 households. At the end of the period, in about 2006, Tbilisi had successfully right-sized about just under 13,000 households. The balance Servcon managed as institute arrangements with the banks, and that program came to a close in about 2007. And that basically covers the historical mandate. Then Tbilisi was given a new lease of life by the minister, based on a letter issued to us in June 2006, and this covered four aspects of a new mandate. Essentially, the first one was upgrading of informal settlements, the unblocking of housing projects, which, if the company doesn't know, totals about 460-odd throughout the country of block projects. The third aspect of that mandate was fast-tracking housing solutions for people in stress. And in this particular instance, we basically talk TRAs and such like. And the fourth key was to be the developer for the two mega projects, that's the N2 and Zanimvula. Unfortunately, as everyone may well know, Tbilisha got into some financial difficulties fairly recently. And this is largely as a result of Treasury not having approved our requested budget. And the reason for that was basically because the mandate given to us by the then minister was not approved by Cabinet. This obviously started the downward spiral, and we became technically insolvent last year. Essentially, what this meant was that we weren't given the quantum of funding required, and this put us at a terrible risk, which culminated in last year's technical insolvency. Thankfully, towards the tail end of last year, in about August of last year, MinMax took the decision to source a lifeline, and essentially they allowed us to utilize interest income on monies paid in advance by provinces. This, in fact, has kept us afloat all of this time. And that covered the bulk of our operational expenditure. And that's essentially where we are with the mandate, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are you through now?
Yes, ma'am.
Is there any other... I think we also have to get the information about the closure plan. Or would the members would like to ask her questions in this session? All right. The members would like to call questions on the matter of the mandate. I've noted the Honorable Bowman to be followed by Honorable Singh, Honorable Mashishi, Honorable Gula, and that sequence. Thank you.
Thank you. That was very short and sweet indeed. Can I just ask, my understanding is this lifeline that you're talking about, what I've been able to pick up is a figure of 6.3 million for 2009-10 and 2010-11, another 6.6 million. Is that correct, or have I got it wrong? And then if that is the case, I think we need a bit of detail as to how that is being spent. Thank you.
Madam Chair. Oh, sorry. Chair, thank you. I'm going to contain my questions just to this portion of the presentation. First of all, in light of the fact that Tbilisha is about to be closed down, etc., I'd like to ask why we've got an acting CEO. Why doesn't the exist or the previous CEO, why doesn't he see this process through? Why is it necessary? And I do know that he's been transferred to the HDA, but, you know, why appoint the acting CEO? I believe the captain should go down with the ship. Secondly, Chairperson, and perhaps it goes back to history, but I'm wondering why, and perhaps the National Department of Housing should have answered this question, but if Tbilisha managed to do some 13,000 houses over a period of roughly 6 to 7 years, why on earth, when their mandate was changed, did the minister believe that they could handle, first of all, the N2 gateway, which initially was 22,000 homes, plus the upgrading of informal settlements, plus a few other projects? Because clearly they didn't have certainly the manpower or the expertise to, in fact, take on that mandate. Then the last question, why did Treasury refuse the funding that they applied for? There must have been a very specific reason, because they were a critical component in the delivery of housing, particularly with a new mandate. So I'm curious to know why Treasury refused the funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question was covered by Honorable Woman. And then the other question, I didn't understand the bulletin number 3. I need some clarification on it. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I've been partly covered by the other speakers, but of prime importance is the issue of the National Treasury and the refusal to fund further. Now, I wanted to know as to if the lifeline was utilized, what percentage from the National Treasury against the lifeline will be offset? And actually, did the lifeline assist in having you to conclude your mandate, and to what extent? The other matter, Comrade Chair, was the issue of the mandate of building the 13,000 homes. Now, when this agreement was concluded, when did Tbilisi find themselves in trouble? In the process of them acquiring more of these mandates and continuing to continue their mandate, or have they completed certain projects and the constraints came about in the future mandate? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you respond on that one? But I'm also interested on the unblocking of the blocked projects. When you were appointed, how many blocked projects were there, and then how many did you manage to unblock them for that period? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you can start off with the first question from the Honourable Member. We're talking about funding of 6 million for 2009-2010. That's quite true. That's due and payable to us. We're still awaiting the transfer of funds to that. But that just contributes to a portion of our operational costs. The balance is made up by the interest income that we're currently receiving from money that are advanced by provinces. So it doesn't make a very, very substantial contribution to this. Now, the question of how Treasury arrived at the 6 million is unknown to me. And perhaps Mr. Nkobe Zulu from National can enlighten us on the process that was adopted then. The second question regarding the acting CEO, if I may answer some of that. Chair, there were some serious governance flaws when the CEO at the time resigned in 2006, at the end of 2006. And since then, we've had acting CEOs for the period 2007 to date. This was the shareholders' responsibility to ensure that we had some continuity in the leadership and management of the organization, and it was really their prerogative to decide how to do it. We also had a board which was operational for about maybe just a little under 1.5 years. Again, in about August of last year, the board became dysfunctional because lots of board members had resigned, with the result that we could not form a quorum. National obviously advised of the situation, and unfortunately, the board wasn't reinstated to its full contingent. Well, the result that we have an acting CEO now who has taken the responsibility for the PFMA as being the board. The third question about why did the minister think we could handle additional mandates? Now, at the time when Tbilisi was established, the thinking was that the right-sizing program would have been completed by about March 2006. At that juncture, Tbilisi also would have had to close. As a special purpose vehicle, it had a very finite lifespan. The minister, in her wisdom, and I approached Tbilisi. I believe that she thought Tbilisi could actually contribute and add value to the housing environment. Hence the reason for extending the mandate. The third question regarding the refusal of funding by Treasury. We were definitely led to believe that because the mandates hadn't been approved by Cabinet, Treasury could not advance monies based on a letter received from the Minister. It had to be approved by Cabinet before they were mandated to pay us any funding. And then again, I think Mr. Ngomazulu can shed some light on that as well. Madam Chair, the next question regarding bullet number 3, talking about the fast-tracking of housing solutions for people living in areas of stress. Basically, this relates to instances where informal settlements are levied by fires, transitional housing for trying to, typically, if you look at the M2, that's typically what this is all about as well, where we decant people into TRAs. And essentially, that's what it is. But really, it's for emergencies as well. We haven't had too much of that. We had some work done in the Eastern Cape at one juncture. And I think there might have been some in the Western Cape, and I'm open to correction there. With regards to the lifeline that was thrown to us, Chair, one of the major reasons for our board having resigned was essentially because the company was technically insolvent. And there was no way out, especially the fact that there was no funding forthcoming from Treasury. And at the MINMAC meeting, it was agreed that we would utilize interest income. And that seems to have been the only methodology that the department could have used to actually ensure that we had some funding to keep us as a going concern. And what has happened here is this lifeline, at the end of the closure of Tulu Bulisha on 31st of July 2009, all money that has been advanced to Tulu Bulisha will be returned to the respective provinces. Tulu Bulisha have managed the wrong word would be a mess, but they have been able to collect funding that should see them through for the balance of the closure, outside of having to pay creditors and some of the bigger, larger expenses, such as retention packages, VSPs, and such like. That would come from funding, which will be covered by my CEO, John Duarte, in his closure status. With regards to the question regarding the 13 homes that were built in respect to the right-sizing program, 13,000, and when did Tbilisha get into trouble? I'm sure quite a number of people suggest Tbilisha were in trouble from the day we started. Because admittedly, at the time, Tbilisha didn't have a very good track record, and certainly 13 houses over a period of 5-6 years is not a very admirable achievement. However, this may sound as an excuse, but that was a very difficult environment to work in, especially with the right sizing, where you were trying to take people out of bonded houses and move them into an RDP house. The guy was used to a 70, 80, 90 square meter house, and the next month he was sitting in a 30 square meter house. And there was a lot of reluctance by the targeted beneficiaries to actually move that way. And this is the reason why we had so much trouble in trying to get that program going. To such an extent where, at the end of the period, 50% of the original target, we had to right-size in situ. Many of the banks had paid out, the government had paid out banks to allow the beneficiaries of the time to remain in the houses that they had occupied all this time and which were bonded. So it wasn't a terribly successful program, and on the basis of what we had achieved, it was probably only about a 50% success rate. With regards to how many block projects we had embarked on, this was from the period 2006, and we must have handled about 30 odds of those block projects in various provinces. That too, block projects is a very, very difficult program to manage, because every single one needs auditors, an audit to be taken of each and every individual house that was built, what was spent on it, what does it cost to actually rectify the house and such like. And, yeah, it's a very difficult program, and unfortunately, my very respectful and humble and considered view, I think it's going to take quite a long time to actually get that behind us. Okay, and also one of the other major things that we had as well in lots of these provinces was that a few of them, a very few of them, were very cooperative in trying to resolve those issues. When Tbilisi embarked on the new mandate, they actually had difficulty selling themselves to the provinces. And it was a painstaking exercise to actually get to where we are today. Chair, just as a matter of interest, this past financial year has been one of the best performing years of Tbilisi from a housing delivery perspective. We had a plan of 9,000 units for the year ending 2009, and we successfully built just under 8,300 houses. That was about 600 short of our target. And, Chair, I think it's a feather cap for Tbilisi to have achieved that number after so many years of having had a real uphill battle in this environment. Chair, thank you.
There's a follow-up from Mr. FA and the Honorable Foreman. Who else? Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, it is follow-up questions. It is my understanding that the, and I'm getting back to the CEO, when we had the HDA before us, they indicated that the Chief Executive Officer of Tbilisi has been transferred to the HDA and is now a Deputy CEO there. But it doesn't gel with what you told me in terms of a CEO resigning, etc. I wanted to know, my question was, why did the CEO, as far as I'm concerned, prematurely transfer to HDA instead of seeing this process through and leaving it up to an acting CEO? Then the second question, Chair, and I'm a bit concerned because, and I don't want to bring up other issues here, but it would appear that we're not getting, when we get briefings, that we don't get all the information or the correct information, because certainly when Tbilisi was given a new mandate, we were made to understand, obviously, and assume that mandate was legal and it was above board. Now, if Cabinet hasn't approved the mandate, as we're hearing here today, then, to my mind, even if perhaps the minister has given them the mandate, but there must be a reason why Cabinet hasn't approved it, and therefore Treasury hasn't given them the funding. It then questions that mandate. And we certainly weren't given that information. We naturally, up until now, assumed that they had a legal mandate. And then just related to that, surely if you're going to take over projects or manage them on behalf of provinces, there's a management fee. So your operating capital couldn't just have come from interest on whatever investments or whatever. There should have been a management fee from provinces, which would have made you more liquid. And perhaps we would not have found us, or you would have not have found yourselves in the position that you're in. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Yes, I just want to get back to the budget allocation again and the lifeline amount. Can you tell us then, those were two separate amounts, what was the lifeline amount? And then the other part of my question again is, even although you don't know how it was arrived at, there must be surely some sort of a business plan that required an amount of money that was submitted. And I think we need to know how much money, because you're going to take this money, how is it going to be spent, even although you don't know, where it's going. The other thing, when you were appointed, and I understand how difficult your mandate must have been in the right sizing program, were you not aware at the time you were appointed that it was going to be a difficult mandate and that you could or you could not have managed it at the beginning? Thank you.
Why did they continue the project if the Cabinet refused to approve it? Or is a normal thing for them? They can go to hell, we are going forward.
Can you
have a Madam Chair, thank you very much. The question of the CEO. Madam Chair, that's a very, very valid question. The problem is that statement was made by the minister at the time, where she said the CEO of Tbilisi, acting CEO of Tbilisi, will become the deputy CEO of the HDA. This, in fact, didn't transpire. And just recently, about a month and a half ago, I got a letter instructing us to employ the acting CEO for another year. So the fact of the matter is there is going to be no, our CEO is not going to be a deputy of the HDA. The second question regarding liquidity. Sorry, I missed the question there. What is the question regarding liquidity?
I questioned the effect that they lack operating capital because they seem to survive on some sort of interest. And that if you're managing projects on behalf of the provinces, that surely there's a management fee that should that you should be getting, which should assist with your operating expenses.
Ah, thank you. Yes. My apologies for that. No, very definitely. We do charge a management fee on some of the projects. The other projects, we get the full subsidies from provinces, and we negotiate a lesser contract value with contractors. So that's where we derive our operation income from. But over and above that, to talk about the additional funding, where we get it from is, on average, from the interest income earned from all monies that have been advanced to us by provinces, we earn on average about 2 million rands per month on that interest income. And between that and the management fee, we've managed to sustain ourselves. Regarding your lifeline amount, to answer the other question, again, the average interest income is about 2 million rands a month, and that's what's seen us through in addition to the management fees that we get from provinces. With regards to the business plan and the download of only about 6 million rands, the actual our actual request at the time for the new financial year was about 130 million rands. And this is why I'm not too sure how the 6 million rands relates to the 130 million rands. And Mr. Ngoma Zulu, I'm sure, is readily available to answer that question. With regards to another question regarding the management of mandates and why continue with projects, Chair, at the time when we were given these mandates, I think, you know, that was done at the behest of the minister, and we would have assumed that, you know, if there are any legalities to be met, that would have been done as a matter of course by the department. We were instructed to do this, and this is what we did. We continued with the projects, and it was basically business as usual. And what transpired at the time is we were trying to reinvent ourselves because there was the potential to lose about 60, 70 staff members at the time. And we thought with new mandates, we certainly could ensure continued employment of our staff and at the same time contribute to housing delivery in the country. And we were terribly eager to take on these mandates. Now, someone suggested that they were rather difficult mandates. And Madam Chair, believe you me, the kind of business we went into just to sustain ourselves and for the sake of longevity, we went into projects that no one else would touch with a barge pole. They are the most difficult projects to actually handle. And that more or less, I think, covers most of the questions.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
Why should you continue the project if the cabinet refused to approve it?
Chair, I think I'm going to answer that.
Okay.
As part of my answer. From the side of the department, Madam Chair, honorable members, when the minister gave Tbilisi a new mandate, she went to cabinet. We submitted a submission to cabinet on emergency housing that Tbilisi be given a mandate to deal with emergency housing. And in that memorandum, these
other aspects of the mandate, like unblocking, like upgrading informal settlements, were implied. In fact, in some cases, they were explicit. When Cabinet approved the emergency housing a program, which Tuvelisha was given a mandate of, we assumed as a department that it is a blanket approval of everything which is contained in that cabinet memo, the copy of which we have. Now, it's a question of interpretation, because in the view of Treasury officials, I'm talking about officials now, at official level, they felt we should have had a specific mention of the fact that Tuvelisha will be dealing with mega projects, which to me is the same as upgrading of informal settlements. Is part of that. So it was a question of interpretation. But let me tell you that when this emergency housing program was approved by Cabinet, a seed capital was given to Tuvelisha. I can't remember offhand, but I think it was a substantial amount. 50 million just to increase their capacity to be able to handle with that. Now, subsequent years, when we went to Treasury to request for additional funding, there was this argument, and they said we can only grant to Tuvelisha operational costs. Now, this 6 million, at first it was I can't remember offhand because I'm not dealing with finances. But since that time, year after year, there have been allocation to Tuvelisha. Now, one may ask, why allocate funds to Tuvelisha if the mandate has not been approved? So on one hand, Treasury is saying your minister did not get an approval of mandate. On the other hand, we are prepared to give you only this portion of the money for Tuvelisha. Why give the money when the mandate is legal? So I'm going to say to the committee, it was just a question of Treasury trying to exercise its own authority over the department. Now, the issue of why should they continue doing that? There has been a lot of discussion between the minister, our minister, the former minister, Lindiwe Sisulu, and the Minister of Finance on this issue. Unfortunately, this was not resolved by the time the term of office of the previous government came to an end. And we know today that the former minister is now the Minister of Defense. And meanwhile, we are looking at how we can wind up Tuvelisha in order that HDA should carry the mandate. Another issue which is not coming out clearly here is that the business model of Tuvelisha was problematic. We had to sit down with Tuvelisha on a number of occasions to say, guys, you are under costing. Because if you are going to go to where ordinary contractors, developers would not go, and you go and take up those projects, there is something wrong with the business model. That's why you are running at a loss. So change the business model. We have done that. We try to assist Tuvelisha. The third thing which is not coming out is that when the N2 project was signed, there were three parties there. It was the province, it was national, it was the local authority. I don't want to go into politics, I mean official. You all know what happened when there was a change of administration of the city. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ngomizulu. I think I will give the opportunity to the members. Honorable Ndate is not satisfied. A follow-up, please.
Yeah.
I'm not satisfied, but I'd like us to continue after that question because some of the other questions will probably come up in the other presentation.
Please, did you notice that the government refused to approve of this project? And what did you do?
Thank you, Chair. The project was a flagship project of the minister. In fact, not of the minister, of the government. The government wanted to see these projects succeeding. Remember, it was a unique project where we are having three parties involved. Now, if one party is not pulling, you don't abandon the project because one party decides it's deciding not to pull. We were aware that there are difficulties. We thought we would overcome those difficulties. There was a big money which was due to Belisha, which was withheld until this year. It was paid this year. Now, you can imagine when was the project started. When was the N2 project initiated? That MIG funding was only paid this year. So there are many hurdles, but we were aware that there are problems. We thought we would overcome those problems.
Shall we get to the next presentation so that we try to wrap up?
Thank you, Chair. I'm John Duarte, the acting CEO of Tubulisha. I'll be dealing with the second portion of the presentation, if that's in order. Thank you, honorable members. My appointment as acting CEO was about June last year, with a specific mandate for this closure process. A closure plan was prepared around about September 2008 and approved by the minister around about 15th of December 2008. There was a bit of a delay in the approval of that particular plan. We had a certain deadlines, etc., that we had in the original plan, and because it was only approved around about the 15th of December, we had to revise the closure time frames and update some of the costs that we had estimated in that particular plan. We updated the plan and submitted it to the department around about the 28th of January 2009. And the steering committee request for commitment from the NDH at the department at that time for closure costs was received on the 3rd of March. To expand on that particular element, as you well know from the presentations either before this meeting and at this one, was that Tubulisha was technically insolvent, therefore did not have the funds to do the closure on its own. And that was a very important part of the mandate for closure, to have a guarantee for closure costs. Otherwise, this would not have worked. Having received that, the implementation of the closure process commenced then around about the 9th of March with that guarantee for closure costs by the department. We then split that into about four teams to deal with the closure. That was a team to handle the human resources, team to handle the project, a team to handle the facilities and assets, and of course the finance and accounting. The department assisted Tbilisi by engaging a company to assist with the closure, to provide all of the technical and legal know-how for this particular process. Now, if we look at the human resource task team, there's been quite a bit of work done up to date. I will explain some of the anomalies that you'll see in the dates that we have here. We negotiated with the HDA for the absorption of quite a number of the staff, particularly around the mega projects, which is the N2 Gateway and Zanavula in the Eastern Cape State. The HDA then confirmed all of the staff in the Western Cape and offered them positions. Subsequent to this report, they also offered positions to the people in the Eastern Cape and the smattering elsewhere. You'll see from a table a little later on how that is split up. A firm undertaking from the Northwest Province to absorb 5 staff members that we've received and 2 still to be redeployed. Northern Cape will absorb 2 staff members. Now, when I say Northern Cape, these are the people that fall outside of the mega projects, the N2 Gateway, what we would term as the provincial housing projects. So, the Northern Cape province will absorb 2, and 1 staff are being offered a position in the HDA. Voluntary service packages have been taken up by 30 staff members. Staff where no commitments have yet been made is 40, and this is in the table that we're presenting here. The total staff that we have currently is 124. Just to give you an indication of how this actually worked out, around about the beginning of last year, we were standing at the staff complement of around about 250 people. Many have resigned up to this point. 30 people, as we mentioned earlier, have taken the voluntary severance package. There was 1 person resigned at head office. In Northwest, we're boarding a person due to health reasons, and we unfortunately lost a member now recently in KwaZulu-Natal. The HDA will take a total of 44 people. Most of them will be on the Zanavula in the Eastern Cape and on the N2 Gateway, 22 people. These us with the province, as I mentioned earlier, Northern Cape will take 2 and Northwest will take 5. Obviously, you must accept the fact that negotiations are still ongoing and that can still change before the end of this month. That is where we have the 40 people which we have not allocated, transferred, or have any guarantees of jobs yet. And it's a very concerning aspect at this point in time for Tbilisi and for those particular families. Like the redeployment of staff to Gauteng and KZN has got its little unique little problem, is that they are prepared to take some of those staff members, but they want us to finance it because they have not received the financing in this particular financial year, and that is creating a problem for them. So they will take the staff if we can also transfer their salaries at the same time. We've made progress with staff changes in the Provident Fund and medical aids, and consultants have been engaged, and we are in the process of finalizing that. Part of the packages for the staff, which we mentioned here, is that they had garage cards and they had access to national 3G contracts, etc. We have canceled those, and we're in the process of clearing those out. The way forward that we see at this point in time, as far as the human resources are concerned, is that we are looking for the approval from the department for the what they call a subvention element, which is the money and the staff move at the same time to KwaZulu-Natal and to Gauteng. An alternate to the above, which is probably not palatable, is that the 40 staff remaining staff members at the end of July will transfer to the department. You notice we're not trying to steer away from retrenchment and that sort of thing. We have a mandate to ensure that everybody is employed as far as possible. We have ongoing meetings with Limpopo, KZN, and Gauteng provinces, and we're going to have follow-up meetings with them as time progresses. Finalization of the VSPs including tax directives. We are busy finalizing those. As you can well appreciate, we have short notice here at this point in time. We are finalizing in writing, et cetera, with the employment of those people in HJ and the ones in the provinces where we have received guarantees that they will take our staff. We then move on to the facilities. Rental agreements, et cetera, have been cancelled. We've tendered the cancellation costs to the department. We are waiting the department to come back to us on that. We have done very well in those negotiations. We managed to save quite a bit of money. As Telkom, we finalized. We sent letters to Telkom. We're canceling by the end of this month. As you can well imagine, we've got a few offices that we must close by the end of this month and transfer everything. All furniture for the transfer to the HD and head office and Gauteng branches have been identified. The balance of the furniture will be auctioned to either staff or disposed as per the closure plan. But this, we must emphasize, with the approval of Treasury. The Western and Eastern Cape assets will be transferred to the HDA also with Treasury approval, as the assets in the Northern Cape and Northwest provinces, which we are proposed along with the transfer of the staff, because they require those assets, and then the Limpopo, KZN, East London will be dealt with the provinces as we negotiate with them. And, of course, my computer wants to freeze up. Sorry about that. For facilitations, all the loan contracts, such as those with coffee machines and et cetera, all been cancelled as of the 31st of July 2009. Some of the things that we need to do on the way forward is the national cards, as we said earlier, by no later than the end of this month. Collection of unused national printers to be handled by the staff to get them back either to the owners of those. You know, there's other machines also, printers, et cetera, that we have to do that with. And we then go for the auction once we have actually got the approval from Treasury. The project. We've been engaging various provinces in transferring projects to them. There's a lot of that have been completed, so we have to get the documentation back to them. There are some that are partially completed, on which we have to negotiate at which point they take them over. Obviously, they have not planned for this either, so there are a few tiers that have been shared on that side. We had meetings on the 30th of June with the Eastern Cape, Limpopo, Western Cape on the 8th of July, and Mpumalanga still to be determined. Mpumalanga is not a very big issue because we've virtually completed all of those. It's just a matter of handing over the paperwork and getting it audited and signed off. Draft contracts have been done. These are where we have to transfer, in the first instance, seed the mega projects to the HDA. We've got to get that paperwork done. That is the contract that we have between Tbilisi and the province. Then there's further sessions that we have to do once we've done that, is to seed the contractors' rights and obligations together to the HDA as well. Now, that we can only do once we've got provincial approval for that. As my colleague had mentioned earlier, if there's any monies left over once audited, that will also go back to the provinces. Notification to the creditors has been sent out will be sent out by the 31st of July. In fact, we have brought that forward. We've started doing that now. We don't know what the effect of this is going to be because we're dealing with a lot of emerging contractors, etc., but we'll deal with that on a case-by-case basis. Key focuses of the project closure team will be a financial reconciliation of all the projects after the discontinuation of the operations by the 31st of July. As you can well appreciate, there will be some work still to be done to get the final accounts out. We don't know how complex that would be until we have got all of our complaints, documentation, etc. in. We had a loan with the National Housing Finance Corporation. We have managed to settle that. There are some meat debtors of approximately 60 million rand still to be received. We're working on that. There was the issue when we got our VAT, when we were zero-rated for VAT. We still have to get all of that money through. We're negotiating with SARS. SARS is working very well with us as far as those creditors are concerned. And I can't say at this point in time how successful we would be with that. It turned out to be quite a complex little venture. We've, as I said earlier, we've submitted a portion of the closure costs to the department so that we can settle the VSPs and terminate the contracts. We have not received this as yet. We're in the process of bringing our financial records up to date. That would be A, when we do our operational closure, and we must emphasize there are two types of closures that we've got. We are closing operationally at the end of this month. There will be a small team that we will keep on board to finalize the financial records and to take care of any other legal aspects that we have to. We are busy analyzing, reanalyzing our clients, our suppliers, etc., and we're collecting whatever monies that we're supposed to collect from them. That will take some time to do as well. We have met with the NHFC with regards to the settlement of the interest of the loan. I must admit here that we took a bit of a chance to see if we couldn't get it for free. That did not work. So we're going to have to pay them the interest. But we have made provision for that. We're in the process of negotiating with HDA regarding the future of those NIC debtors that we've got above there, if it should go beyond the closure period that we have. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the VAT refunds. I've got that at this point in time. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Acting CEO. I'm inviting the questions from the honorable members, honorable Stein, to be followed by honorable Bowman, honorable Bula. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just want confirmation that Tubelisha will be laid to rest at the end of this month. They won't exist anymore. Is that correct? And then, Chairperson, something that's a little bit puzzling. When the first presenter introduced, he said he was the acting CEO.
COO.
Was it the COO? My apologies then. But he also said, in reply to one of my questions, that he's been instructed to employ the acting CEO for another year. Which leads me to the question, if Tbilisi is not going to exist after the end of this month, and yes, there's going to be a small team, why employ the acting CEO for another year?
That was the deputy, this one.
Well, whichever CEO has to be employed for another year, I want to know why they want to make an employment for another year.
And
why
was
for 12
the letter
months?
Coming from? That's what where was the letter coming from?
I think the letter came from the minister. But the question around the employment for another year, when we're trying to transfer staff, we make an employment of the most senior employee for another year. Then how does the closure now compare to the original time frame? Now, you did in the beginning indicate all the problems about the National Department approving the closure plan, etc. But when they came before us last year, there was a very specific time frame set up. And that was presented, in fact, by the National Department of Housing. So there's a bit of confusion over there, this them having to accept some sort of time frame, which was only done now in March 2009, when we certainly had that presentation last year sometime, Chairperson. 250 employees, and there's now 124, which means roughly half of them have resigned. I'm concerned that possibly... and there are exceptions, but possibly some of our very skilled people have actually resigned and gone somewhere else. And we're now left with the people that are perhaps not as skilled, and I'm talking very general there. There are certainly people that we need to retain their skills, and it may be one of the reasons why we're having difficulty to transfer them. And is the option, you know, I'm very mindful of the economy at the moment and that we don't want to necessarily have people unemployed. But, I mean, surely, if and it brings me to the other question, Chairperson, there appears to be provinces that are reluctant to take staff, yet we are transferring the projects to them. Now, the original idea was the provinces couldn't handle the projects. That's why Tbilisi did it. Now we're transferring the project without the staff. So it's a recipe for a disaster, which leads me almost to the conclusion that the staff that we want to transfer are probably not the most competent, and that's why the provinces don't want them. Now, do we really have an obligation if somebody is not competent and doesn't have the skills that we need to find somewhere for them just to continue drawing a salary even if they can't do the job? I think it's a question mark that needs to be looked at very seriously. Then Just in terms of the gentleman from the Department of Housing indicated that the MIG funding, or they received some MIG funding very recently. The $60 million that you're talking about, is that excluding what has been received recently? And then the last comment, Chairperson, I'm a little bit concerned that there's some analysis going on of creditors and debtors at this point and going into the end of this month. Surely there is work that should have been done already, and we should have almost a 99% idea of exactly who owes their money and who they owe money, so that we know exactly what the status is. And that was the picture that was given to us last year when they were reluctant to say that they were bankrupt, and I had to force the issue and use the word that Tbilisi was bankrupt, after which they admitted it. So there must be, I'm just concerned that we're either not getting all the information here, or that, in fact, they don't have all the information yet, which is equally concerning.
Chairperson, I've largely been covered. I just want to add on to the question of the small task group now remaining to do the winding up. What is the time frame for that? If the July is the cutoff for Tbilisi, what is your time frame now for the small committee just to finish off the that's just in addition to what's already been asked? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I've also been covered extensively. But what comes out very, very clear is the issue of employment. And if it is said that by the 31st of July is the foreseen closure date, then I think we need to know and understand that why employment must continue. But it is very, very important also to get the final statement of finances between the creditors and debtors. And this will give you an insight as to what kind of future balances or settlements you will achieve. I am afraid that if that is not achieved, then you might be putting the cart before the horse. The other area that is very, very important is that you have indicated that the staff for KwaZulu-Natal will be transferred over only if the salaries are transferred. What happens if the salaries are not you are not in a position to transfer the salaries? What happened to those staff? And you did refer to the meetings in KwaZulu-Natal that's going to take place. I find this rather strange that you haven't reached any finality in the meetings in KwaZulu-Natal, and yet you are taking concrete decisions on the other hand. Just to elaborate more on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Going back to the core business of the department, after getting the presentation from Tbilisi and the department, I wish to pose a question to the department, whether are we going to see things being done differently and get value for money? Because in the words of the CEO says, from the beginning, Tbilisi had problems. Now we are transferring most of the staff to HDA, and are we certain that things will now be done differently and get value for money, and not experience the same problems in the different skin, but same people, same operation? Thanks, Chair.
I think I've got one question about this, the transfer of the furniture, of the equipment. We are expecting the response from the National Treasury, the approval. But there's no time frame. Seemingly, this thing is just open. There is no time frame to ensure that this program is wrapped up. And another thing, you've raised the issue of the projects that has to be handed over to the various provinces. Yeah, we are certain about Mpumalanga. Even the committee is certain. There are no blocked projects in Mpumalanga. That one, we can just commend the work of whoever was responsible for that. But I think it is important for the committee to know from these outstanding provinces how many projects that are supposed to be transferred, because it's also going to be the oversight of the committee to ensure that those projects that are going to be transferred to HDA. We want to know HDA what are the time frames for HDA to complete those projects. So I think it's important for the committee to get the figure of those projects. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think what's important to realize here is this is a mini type of liquidation exercise. Okay. This is not something that you say that we're going to just walk out of this room now and switch off the lights and it's going to end. There's quite a number of things that we have to do, and quite a number of things that we have to follow. What we also have to realize here is that Tbilisi has a Section 21 company, and thereby must adhere to the Companies Act. Thirdly, because the shareholder is government, the PFMA applies. So some of the questions about laying this to rest and asking for clear timelines, okay, will it end by the end of this month, we need to consider this very carefully. What we said in our closure plan is that operationally, Tbilisi will close. Everything will shut down except for the closure team. We cannot put a time frame on how long that closure team will continue. Let me give you an example. HR will probably operate for another 30 days, perhaps 60. Why? Because we still have to do the final VSPs, the taxation, UIF, reconciliations, etc. So I can't tell whether it's going to take 30, 60, or 90 days. So that part of the team may not be there for 10 months. This is the complexity of this. The other thing that we've got to be realized here is this organization Tbilisi, is probably bigger than, say, the contractor that we use in Cape Town, such as Ibuyile or Sobambisana. If you look at its cash flow, it's quite a large enterprise. If you look at its cash flow and look at the staff that has managed it, probably not enough people. I've had these comments from some of the contractors that we work with. Let's say, how do you actually get the work done with so few people? I just want to sort of lay the groundwork so it's understood what the complexity is that we've got to deal with here. What we've got to deal with here also is that a lot of negotiations. Okay, let me just move on to the next point. The next point was, why employ the CEO? Somebody's got to head this thing. It has to have an accounting officer that heads it. It's required by law. If we said that we just walked out and give it to one of the other staff members to deal with or a consulting firm, this is not going to work in the eyes of the law. As my colleague mentioned earlier, is that there was a defunct board. There is no board. So the CEO becomes the board in terms of the law. So you have to have the CEO in place to finalize these matters. Somebody, an executive, has got to sign it off. And that is the reason for getting the CEO in and actually getting somebody senior to deal with these matters and to take it forward. As to why my colleague appoints the CEO, this is where the unique thing comes in. There's no board to appoint the CEO. So we have to use another representative within the organization to deal with the shareholder to get that appointment done. And that is why it had this funny way of having to do it. It's just bringing in some semblance of corporate governance into it so it doesn't lie with somebody outside of the organization. Because it is a sovereign company and has to be dealt with in that fashion. I think I dealt with the time frames earlier. Time frames, yes. One time frame we're very sure of is that there will be no Tbilisi staff at the end of this month. We will contract with people to be on board, and we'll be very clear in those contexts that it will be until that particular job or that phase is completed and you will not have any work. So it will be on a contractual basis. Why do we offer this to a lot of the people within Tbilisi? Let's take, for instance, our finance department. We can't go and bring in Deloitte and Touche. They do not understand the operations. Although we use the Deloitte and Touche for the auditing, and we use them for all of the other aspects of governance, we still need to have people who understand the business, who understand where the money is, etc. Yes, it's true. The 250 people, the 125. It is natural. The people that leave first are the people who can't find jobs. Yes, it is true. We are left with the people now who are not as skilled as those, but that doesn't make them less important. We still have to take care of them. We still have to ensure that we can find them employment. As far as possible, we can do this. And we at Tbilisi, realize this is not necessarily the case all the time. We are going to fail. We hope we're not going to fail. If we fail, what that means is these people will be retrenched. And that kind of trauma we cannot transfer to them, because the closure of Tbilisi is not their fault. So we have to take care of them. Not even considering we have a caring government and things like that. This is just good sense to do this. It's just fair. It's morally sort of over high ground, I suppose. I don't know. The provinces, if you look at the time frames, we actually only got our mandate around about March. We've been running around like March hares, negotiating with all parties that we could. One of the unique things that we find is that people make promises and then turn around a month later and change their minds. I'll give you an example in question. KZN was one of them. We were sure they were taking people. When we came to them and said, Simon and Dot and I, they went to the 360-degree turn. This went for just about every other party that we had to talk to, internally, externally, whatever the case may be. We kept having reneging taking place until we started threatening. And we are threatening because we want to make sure that the people that we've got within Tbilisi are taken care of. This is not trying to be overly good about the whole thing. I just think it's good sense to do that. The MIG funding has always been a problem. I think I would ask my colleague there to help me because he's the operational officer. I'll give it over to him a little later just to answer the question on the MIG funding. Time frames we've done, the finances, right? The finances, your normal finances are year end is March. We do our normal finances. But at some point, we've got to do a closure account, which we've got to give to all parties concerned, those closure accounts, and we've got to make sure that they're correct. This calls for analysis in areas where we feel there might be a risk, where we might have overlooked something. This is a very complex business. The complexity here in doing analysis is, let's say, for instance, we have a project in the Western Cape, in Mandela Park, which doesn't form part of the N2 gateway. We've built, out of the 300 houses, we've got 50 foundations, 20 wall plates, etc. This has got to be analyzed. This has got to be quantified. This has got to be done correctly so that when that transfer takes over, if that transfer is to the province, we must make sure that once it's signed off, it is correct, so that if we do sit in a meeting like this again, after that, we have got all the answers that we can give you. So we are doing all of this to make sure that it is correct. Again, I'm just saying it's not a question of just saying we're now closing, we're walking down, switching off the lights. We must accept this is a complex closure process. It's a voluntary liquidation, and therefore has to adhere to certain principles. How many projects are transferred? We didn't prepare that in this particular presentation. We would be glad to come back here and give you all of the details that you need as far as those projects are concerned. The fortunate thing about this is that this closure process, although authorized only at the beginning of this year and started around about March, this closure process started actually quite some time back. We stopped taking on new projects. To understand what that means to Tbilisi, remember they asked the question, how do you sustain yourself? It's a decreasing sustainability. And as we progress with this, and longer we take, the less and less money we get as Tbilisi from any operations that we have, because we're finishing off projects. So it's a tricky way of doing this to ensure. We're only glad, not glad really, that because we went down from 250 to 125 people and still managed to sustain ourselves, we also have to look at it that we also have a load on the requirement for financing. So with the tapering projects, tapering income, and tapering costs, I think we're more or less on a winning streak here. So the projects have been transferring. That will be all be contained in reports, etc. We've made sure that we brought in some governors. We brought an outside third-party company to actually watch us in terms of how we're clearing this up. We've established a closure committee consisting of people from Treasury, people from the department, people from within Tbilisi, various watchdogs that we put on the committee to ensure that we make sure that we're doing this process correctly and we're covering all the bases. I am appreciative of all of the questions that you have asked at this meeting because some of them have actually started me thinking that there are some places that we must be very careful of and we must go and have a relook at. I hope I've answered all of the questions that you have posed up to this point. If there's anything I left out, please let me know.
Department.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on the question of the MIG, the department mentioned earlier that we had received MIG funding just very early this year. That related specifically to the NHFC loan that we took out a few years ago to fund some of the MIG expenses. This is totally outside and separate of that, and this is additional MIG funding that's still due to us for work that has already been done. So there's nothing to do with the 100 million. It's totally separate.
On the issue of whether are we going to get value for money, I believe especially the N2 project has there are lessons to be learned out of that. Zanimvula, in fact, is better implemented than the N2 because we learn from the N2. That's why there are no problems with Zanimvula, and we believe now with the HDA. There will be far more improvement. We are not just transferring staff to the HDA, the question of new wine in old skin. No. We are transferring expertise, which needs to complete those projects. And the way in which HDA is going to be run will be different because there are lessons which we have learned from the operations of Tbilisi and Safcon. Let me just assure you that there would be improvement. Thank you, sir.
On to the other presentation. Do you want to make a follow-up? Okay. And that
Chair, just a quick follow-up. I'm almost willing to bet money on the fact that there's not a province in this country that doesn't have vacancies in their housing department. And therefore, I'm concerned that we are transferring projects to provinces that cannot handle the existing projects that they've got, and yet they are reluctant to take staff that are familiar with those projects. Now, there must be a very good reason, hopefully, from these provinces why they do not want to take that staff. And you know, a question about transferring the staff with the money. If you look at the annual reports, very many of those vacant positions are, in fact, funded positions. So I think the national department needs to take this up seriously because they're not going to do anybody any favors by taking the projects and refusing some of the staff if they've got the capacity and the money. Then just a very pertinent question, simply because it came up in the responses. Who or what is responsible for the failure of Tbilisi? In one of your replies, you said certainly the staff generally is not responsible. Could you sort of in one sentence then tell me either who or what is responsible for the failure?
I think that's a short question and it does need a short response.
I'll do my best, Chair. Who and what? It was the management within Tbilisi, I think, was the failure. And I'm basing this on the fact that if we look at what was achieved in the last year when I was there, and it was not rocket science, and it wasn't because it was any better. It was that in the last year we showed so much success, it could have been shown in the years before, so it was actually management issues.
Presentation. Yes. Greetings, Madam Chair and honorable members. I'm Khandi Sitau, acting regional general manager for Tubelisha in the Western Cape and the Eastern Cape. My task is to deal with the Joel's logo scenario. Firstly, I will start with the present situation of Joel's logo. That has to do with the march that took place last week. That march was a march from residents who are presently residing in our rental stock, which is also phase one. It is a march of people who say they are dissatisfied with the rentals that they are paying. They say rentals are exorbitant and so forth and so on. But just to put clarity to their issue, before each and every tenant could move into those units, there were interviews that were taken by a company that was appointed by the Provincial Department of Housing in the Western Cape, then a company by the name of PKS. Each one was assessed, and each one had to submit his or her payslip. And after that assessment, the person will be told whether he or she can afford to pay a unit that costs less or in the middle or higher. And after a person, you know, has been given the feedback, he or she would then sign an agreement or a contract to say, yes, I agree, I will pay this amount. So we are talking of people who are defaulters, for starters. Yes, we had problems. There were structural defects on the units which we attended to. So what we expect from the tenants as we speak is for them to adhere to the contracts, the terms and conditions of what they signed for. That's one. Then two, I'll be dealing with the court case. So I don't know whether maybe I should wait or proceed with the court case. I'm through with
the court case. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, the obvious first concern was that the people that are currently tenants was never supposed to be the true, well, I don't want to say beneficiaries really, of those units, but that's another matter. The fact is, as you've indicated, these people were screened. They qualified for the rentals. There were genuine problems initially, and I'm not sure. You have to give us the assurance that the structural problems that started off these people boycotting the rent, they said it's as a result of the condition of the units. You have to give us the assurance that those structural defects have been attended to, which means then that they don't have any grounds for not wanting to pay the rentals, and I believe the law must then take its course, because we cannot afford to lose any more money on those units at the expense of providing housing for the people that truly deserve it and that are waiting out there, that have been waiting another 2 or 3 years because they were supposed to be the beneficiaries of those units. So I think we need to get firm confirmation that those structural defects have been attended to. And it's I don't know, I don't want to go back to the Tubelisha thing, but Tubelisha was in fact the project managers towards the end of this project. And the fact that we're sitting with such structural defects also doesn't give me too much confidence in what Tubelisha has done. But that aside, I think once if we've got confirmation, and perhaps, Chair, and when we come back, we should make another site inspection there and confirm that, in fact, those structural defects have been attended to. Thank you.
Jefferson basically uncovered again. I just want to say that, you know, people out there are desperate for houses. We can't get away from that. But what I do know is that in allocating houses, whether it's rental stock or whether it's, you know, a free house or whatever, we have got to be extremely careful in the criteria that we use and the above board way in which we do it. And I think my concern is just that the final list, and you know, I'm a new member on this committee, so I haven't heard all the previous things that have come through here, but would be that was that screening properly done? I have to ask the question, because very often we say we're doing it or it has been done, but in fact it hasn't. So I just want to emphasize that, you know, those interviews for allocations are extremely important. The structural defects, usually a thing like this starts something else going. And again, I would agree, we need to go on site to actually go and see whether those things have been fixed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, my question is directed to Belisha and also the department. If you look at the Slovo phase one problems, as articulated by the gentleman from Tbilisi, it's not the first of its kind in the country. You go to Cape Town, where there's also rental stock. People get in there. After a few months, they start demanding either buying or getting free or reduce the rental. It's happening everywhere. And I agree with the member. It's because people are desperate. I mean, I'll make sure that I qualify to get to the roof, to get a roof over my head. And immediately after that, I start realizing that I'm in trouble here. And I think we've got a responsibility, either as a committee, government, and everybody who's involved in housing, to say, are we really providing the product that is needed by people and assume that they will afford? Or is it because they are desperate and they make sure that they meet the criteria only to get a roof over their head? And maybe but they don't afford, whether there is that thinking within the department, because it's not the only one in Joslova, it's all over the where you get rental stock, that there are these problems. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think I've been covered partly, but I'm very curious to know the legal aspects of the agreement between the beneficiary. What stance can be taken in view of the non-payment of rental? We must be very, very sensitive to human factors, however, but we must not be seen to create a culture of non-payment. There must be clarity as to the non-payment resulted to what? Either being the defects that put them into a predicament to repair or to sustain themselves in difficult times, or the actual payment of the rent. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. But I think I've got a question on the issue of the initial or original version of the business plan of that rental stock, because from the AG's report, we have learned that it was an affordable housing rental stock initially, and it ranged between, it started at 1,200. For the people are earning 1,200 per month. But when the actual implementation of the program, it raised up to 1,500, the people who have to qualify. So what made those changes up to 5,000, up to 7,500 per month? So are we sure? I'm going back from the question that was asked by Honorable Stay, are we sure that the people who entered on those agreements are the real people that we're supposed to? And then we also come to understand that there has been a change in the design of the houses and some of the, because we have not mentioned that, but there are other areas that have been affected by the changes that came in at random. For instance, the Boys Town, the change of the design of the house. I think if you can just touch that area so that we can understand what made the changes. to those areas.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, starting with the quality of, you know, the phase one units, I think I must put to the attention of this committee that Tubelisha only got involved in this project in 2006. And by that time, I would say in my analysis, phase one was almost 95% complete. And by that time, the implementing agent then was the city of Cape Town. So we inherited the problem from the city of Cape Town. Just wanted to put clarity to that so that at least we might be exonerated from this one, not always to be lambasted as being, you know, useless garbage. Secondly, BKS is a property company. It's a company that is used in other, you know, property developments around town. So, as a company that was, you know, appointed by the Provincial Department of Housing here in the Western Cape, I think it did what it was tasked to do. So I would say proper screening was effectively done. I'm confident on that one. On the legal aspect of those who are not paying rent, yes, if you don't pay, you have to be kicked out. That's the language. But we have tried to negotiate with the defaulters, trying to show them the dangers of them not paying. We have even, you know, brought in the Social Housing Foundation CEO to come in our negotiations. We have brought the Johannesburg Housing Company to come and negotiate. So we have done everything, but our negotiations have failed. The former MEC was there, former MEC Janji, to negotiate with the tenants to pay. They never paid. We were there as Tubelisha. So we have done everything to try and make sense, you know, to the tenants of Joe Slovo, but really, they haven't paid. Now, what we have done was to write letters of notices that we will be evicting them, just as a matter of trying to get sense whether they would really, you know, take cognizance of that. But unfortunately, that seems not to threaten them at all. We are closing come 31st of July. We have now, you know, transferred this task to EHDA as the successor to this project. And HDA is now negotiating with the city, Cape Town Housing Company, to run the project. So I think they will come up with a solution when they move in. On the issue of e-rental costs, what happened is that before those, that's history that I'm told, it says that before those units were completed, there was a certain survey that was done which indicated that the cheapest would be 160 and the most expensive would be 650 rands. But after completion, it became clear that the monies that have been used to put those structures in place have exceeded the estimated amount. And as a result, that also changed the rental amount to 500 rands, the cheapest, and 1,200, the most expensive. So that is what actually caused the figures to vary. And that a formula or model was brought in by Social Housing Foundation and some employees from National Department of Housing. On the issue of designs, on Joe Slovo Phase 1, Madam Chair, there's nothing that, you know, changed. The design for those units is still what is there. And then Boys Town, I didn't prepare anything on Boys Town for this because I was only focusing on Joe Slovo for the purpose of this discussion.
Thank you very much. The department, you want to get, at least I've noted your hand. Let's give the opportunity to the department.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to try and answer the question from Honorable Dlamini, although I'm not an expert on rental issues.
But what I know is that the provision of rental unit is far more expensive than an ordinary RDP. And obviously, even the running costs will be far more than an ordinary four-room house. And taking cognizance that those units are meant for people who are working, mainly, who came to the cities looking for job. We are, they are meant for those, in reality. People who reside in the city, who reside in the area, should be afforded ordinary four-room houses. They should not be in rental stock. Maybe that, whether are we looking, thinking about this as a department, I'm not sure because that's not my unit. Thank you.
Who else? Dr. Porter, Honorable Fuglan, Honorable Bula, Dr. Mzali, on that session.
Thank you, Chair. Just for the benefit of some of my colleagues that may not be aware, I'm going to take a role for the department here. When the units were finally completed, they were in fact more expensive, and therefore the original beneficiaries couldn't take occupation because it was then meant for people that fell outside the waiting list, for one, and secondly it was people, as correctly indicated, that were working. And some members may be aware that I put out a statement last year complete with photographs, because when people started occupying those units, I noticed that there were some very expensive German sedans outside. And I queried the tenants. That's when the department said, well, it's not the people on the waiting list, it was people that were working that were now getting these units. But, Chairperson, a further question would be, what sort of percentage of the tenants is defaulting? Is it almost everybody? Or do we know? Because I suspect that there's a concerted effort by the tenants to in fact try and get a product for the least amount of money. And then I've had no confirmation that the complaints list or the defaults, and I want to make a distinction here, because very often people will complain about something that may not be a real problem. The defaults have been all attended to. That was the one question confirmation. And then are there any other complaints by the tenants that in fact you're saying, but you know, you're really complaining about nothing, there's nothing we can do? If I could have that sort of clarity there, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is more of a comment than a question. I think the question that Honorable Dlamini raises is a very pertinent one. In regard to this, it's not a question that this is only affecting rental stock. I think the department has invited the private sector to build affordable houses to attend to this market that we know is not being addressed because of affordability. And yet, once people are given these houses, they are unable, or for whatever reason, they refuse to pay. That's why CEFCON was created as part of the normalization of bonded houses that are meant to be given to people who claim to afford, because they fall within a particular income category. Now, right now we said, because people can't afford to pay their bonds, we must provide rental housing stock. With the rental housing stock, they find fault with the houses and mobilize on political grounds. And they would be able to justify why they are not paying through finding the fault with the product. And in most cases, they get away with it. Now, the department has got to find some corrective measure of how to stop people using political mobilization and finding all sorts of reasons why payment should not be done. And in the case of N2, there were all sorts of reasons why people refused. One, they refused to move to Delft because they were in the list, or they were part of a group that was either at the backyards or the wrong people were going to be removed, and other people brought into these houses and taken, they would be taken away from town. So there was more politics. Always the N2 gateway issue is really has very little to do with affordability. It has had a lot to do with the politics of Cape Town. The tension between the province and the municipality was itself a problem. The tension between the province and the national and the municipality has been a problem in itself. That's why you have this costing problem itself has come into the to become an issue. Because contractors went onto site, and I don't want to go into that, but contractors went onto site without proper tenders being approved. When they were already there, they said the prices were actually not worth. And the size of the house itself was an issue. 40 square meter or 30 square meter? The municipality says, we would pay for this. The province said, no, but this is what national says, or national says, this is what we want. So all of these have affected the prices of the houses. So these are some of the challenges that this project has been faced with. I think if anything has to be learned in this, there's a lot to be learned not how to do things. And there's a lot of not, we must never do this again in this project. Really, I think if we say Zanele-Vula is a better project, it would be because there's a lot of negative lessons learned from this M2 Gateway project.
Thank you, Chairperson. When you say Honorable Dlamini, I thought you're talking to me. I'm also Dlamini, but Strickland. Chairperson, I just want to raise the issue of people refusing to pay the rent. Question is why? Is there any communication between Tuvelicha and the tenants in N2? The second issue was the repairs being done in the N2 gateway. Third issue is when you say you screen all the people, but most of those people, they are not working. I've been called in the N2 development 3-4 times, and I went through to check why they're complaining, why they don't want to pay rent. Now we must be very honest. And that's why I say communication is the key. We listen to the people why they don't want to pay rent. The default through the project that was building those houses, did we follow that up? Thank you, Chairperson. Those are the questions I wanted to raise.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think it calls for a complete thorough audit in terms of the defaults, etc. But, Chair, I am concerned about, I have been covered by Honorable Stain, but I just want to make sure that I'm on the right track in understanding. Initially, we had beneficiaries. We have created expectations that certain number of, or certain beneficiaries will benefit through the process of the 160 and the 600. And then a little later, we hear that the expectation that we have created for these beneficiaries fell away, and the category of 500 and 1-2 came in. Now, I want to know as to, are these two different categories of people? And if it is, what happened to the people that we have first created an expectation that they're going to be housed?
Chair,
You are told some the house got some structural defects. Who pays for these structural defects? Is it the company that builds the houses or the state pays for it? Who pays?
Thank you, Chair. It's not a question. I think it's a comment and a suggestion. Chair, you remember when we started with this housing project, most especially your Greenfield RDP in 1996, we had big developers and contractors coming in, and they made a mess. So I was making money and go. That's why I came to come back and rectify the mistakes. And they didn't want to touch that market again. Then we started this concept of rental stocks and better units and so forth. And then they're coming back, but now also on their terms. That is why we've got a problem where government says it wants to build units for rental at 160, but it ends up being 500 rand. The same thing is looming, more especially if you look at housing in hostels. There's the problem of this flow, cash flow. I don't know what is it in government. Where now they approach these developers, who are not prepared to build your giveaway units. They will tell you that for each project they want, because of this mixed income concept that we have, they'll want to build 40% giveaway, 30% this, 30% this. Now, our development is not driven by the needs of the people, but it's driven also, again now, by the needs of these big developers. And I would suggest, Chairperson, that I think we need the department, relevant people, not to Mr. Lonala, because he's now put on the spot. That's why I'm putting it as a suggestion. Call the department and also provincial departments to really come and tell us their financial model and all those, their approach and so forth, because we'll end up with this problem. Because here, if you can look, an expectation was created to say units are going to be between 160 to 600 rands. But when the project started, it's now from 500 rand to 600 rand. And yes, there are people who don't want to pay it all, but at the same time, we are also giving them ammunition to mobilize around these issues because an expectation was created. Because unfortunately, South Africa has elections every 5 years. Therefore, we also want to be in power. I can use anything that is there. But that's why I'm suggesting, Chair, that I also see a problem coming because now the department, most especially in provinces, they are also approaching now these big developers who come in their own terms. And they're not driven by the needs of the people. They're driven by their needs to make more money. Thanks, Chair.
You suggest
Chairperson, thank you. I'm a little bit confused. There are some contradictions here. I heard the department talking about the people who occupy those houses are people who are working. And then I heard the Honorable said he did some survey there. There were people who are not working there. And again, I just want to check, before the people get into those houses, do they do the quality monitoring of those houses? Maybe that is why these people didn't want to pay. Thank you.
Okay, I just want to add that, you see, people who qualify for rental stock, they have to be employed people. Mm. And if they are there and they are not working, there must be something that is funny that somebody did to be in that state, because nobody should be qualified to be in a housing rental stock without having gone through a process of selection. That's one. Two, the same thing with the bonded houses. The department approached the private sector that had moved out of this market to say, please come back. Because, one, the small contractors can't afford to build at the rate at which we want housing delivered. Two, some of the land that we were targeting belongs to private companies, and the smaller companies can't afford to buy that land. Therefore, for us to address this housing market, that, or rather the delivery that we want, please come back and bring together with you the funds and the ability to deliver not only to the upmarket, but also
your low, middle, and upper market. So there's cross-subsidization in terms of infrastructure for these houses. And the private sector said, yes, we'll come back. We'll come back on condition that we can do rental housing stock, we can do low-cost housing, we can do middle and high-income housing, so as to cross-subsidize our cost of infrastructure. Now, once they are there, people come in to the houses, and they expect that there should be some payment of bonded, because government only takes the cases of, what do you call it, those who can't,
The indigent.
You see, that's where government comes in. The rest of the people are supposed to be catered for by some degree of payment, those who can afford to pay. Therefore, the issue of the private sector, you see, I don't think we should invite the private sector and then lambast the private sector. Because it's government that has invited the private sector, which had already pulled out of this market. Now, they are saying we'll come in. But we come in provided you create the political conditions that will enable people to pay. And you can't expect us to build houses and people don't pay. That is the reality. And so I think there is a political issue here. Unfortunately, government and politicians issue conflicting messages on these matters. Some say this, some say the opposite. So that is what has got to be addressed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure whether Honorable Fitlane would really want me to answer, because Honorable Botha has answered for me. But because the question maybe was directed to me, let me just answer. When it comes to the issue of communication, Honorable Chair, we have been communicating constantly with the tenants of Joslovo Phase 1. What is presently happening there is subletting, as alluded by Honorable Botha. So that is why maybe when the Honorable Fitlane went there, he met the kinds of people that he met. But those whom we interviewed are people who are working, who had to submit their pay slips, and we will then allocate a unit to that person. The default rate, Honorable Chair, is between 75 and 80%. On the issue of other complaints, there's none that I am aware of that is the actual cause for them to default, other than the issue that has to do with the structural defects. Yes, an expectation was created, but when these people were screened and interviewed, they were screened on the new rates of 500 to 1,200, much as the expedition was created before. Who deals with the defaults? It's the contractor, Honorable Chair, that is responsible to redo what he didn't do right. And on the issue of whether there's proof that we dealt with the quality or the defaults, we do have a report by QS that we appointed to do the exercise, but unfortunately we didn't bring it here. But we will forward it to the Chair. Can I then move to the Joslovo case?
Chair, very quickly, just to add to what the Scandi just mentioned, a question was raised about who pays for the repairs of those units. Initially, we were given a capital grant to do repairs to the units. We virtually spent all that money, and as recently as a few months ago, we bought a guardhouse to the tune of about 200,000 rands. The problem we have right now is that if we don't get beneficiaries to start paying their due rental incomes, there will be deterioration in the environment there. If you look at the actual cost that needs to be expended on a monthly basis, it's close to about 300,000 rands for guarding, cleaning services, as well as maintenance and repairs. With the minimal income that we're getting in the region of about 40,000, 50,000 rands a month, it's impossible to maintain that environment. So something drastically needs to be done in that regard. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
the company, the company that does the repairs. He says they are doing repairs.
No, they are coming from the same.
Same company.
Same company.
No, I mean the company that constructed the houses.
The company
to maintenance that is referring to. But the question was on defects, where I say it's a contractor's responsibility.
It's just a follow-up. Pardon? Yes. Just to follow up on the question of people renting out their houses again, what is in place to control that? And the other thing is, when they are screened and they've been given the allocation of the flat and everything, is there anything in there that says to them that they are not allowed to rent that out to somebody else? So what controls have we got in place to deal with that? Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I've prepared an 8-page document, which is just a summary on the court case, but it's self-explanatory to an extent that I won't even have to deal much with each page. But what I just want to highlight is that this constitutional court judgment is a judgment that came as an appeal that was laid by the residents of Joe Slovo community to the Constitutional Court after Tubelisha, the National Minister and the Provincial MEC of the Western Cape had taken the Joe Slovo community to court here in the Western Cape. And the judgment in the Western Cape High Court was granted in government favor. And the community appealed to the Constitutional Court. We went to the Constitutional Court. We argued the matter. And on the 10th of June, the judgment was then awarded again in government favor. And it has some conditions on which it has to be implemented, wherein people have to be relocated to the temporary relocation areas, which is what we've been always doing. And we have now been mandated to see to it that the size of a temporary unit is as per the instruction, which is 24 square meters. There should be tarred roads, there should be electricity. Everything is stated in this document that I have forwarded. But basically, the instruction that we were given by the court was that we have to start or commence the relocation by the 19th of August, if I'm not mistaken. But unfortunately, we are not in a position to implement this judgment by the 19th. So our lawyers, that is government lawyers and the lawyers of the Joe Slovo community, have met, and we were proposing that we should start or commence relocation by mid-October, that is 19th of October. So basically, that is what I could maybe share with this committee, not unless there is something critical that the committee would like to know. But the summary that I've given to the committee chair is simple, self-explanatory.
Chairperson, I wonder if it would be possible for us also to have a copy of that document, since it's such a long document to be summarized. Is it there? Oh, we've got it. No, I haven't got it. Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay. I would just request the committee to
to cancel paragraph 26, 27, 28. It is at the last page where it says conclusion. Those three paragraphs are not relevant for this exercise. Paragraph 26, 27, and 28. But the rest is relevant. There was the question that the chair advised me to hold. Yes, our contract documents are clear that you don't have to sublet. But unfortunately, as it was alluded earlier on, that politics here, they normally give us problems where we can't even, you know, administer administrative principles. So we have to be guided by politics at some stage. But I think that will come to an end, come the Cape Housing Company that is going to deal with those rental, the rental stock.
Sorry, Chair. I just want to check. There was a split of 30-70, the 30 for the backyarders, on the same project. Didn't that cause maybe some of the people were unemployed and they were catered into the project? That's why we have these problems now.
No, the 70-30 is still applicable. We have never deviated from the 70-30. That 70-30 meant that 70% opportunities will be given to the current residents of the informal settlement of Joe Slovo, and 30% will be given to the current backyarders of Langa. When people were screened, we had people who qualified in Joe Slovo, but who didn't want to take occupation. And as a result, we had to open, you know, now the field to cater for Kukuletu, Nyanga, Pondivu, so that we close the gap, because we couldn't leave units empty, because there are some who qualify in Joslovo but who do not want to take occupation. And again, I think I must also make it clear that those who earn nothing are also, you know, benefiting from government, because they are given the free houses, where government is targeting those who earn nothing to 3,500. Those who earn between 0 and 3,500 a month are given the free houses.
Yeah.
So no, there's no one who's not well looked after.
I think we have come to the end of our program, but just to wrap up the observations from this exercise to this exercise. And I think it's also a provision for the department. I think we all agree that the are lessons that we have learned through the process of N2 Gateway. And I think it's a homework for the department to ensure that, in fact, all of us, that these things do not happen. And secondly, I think as the portfolio committee, the previous portfolio committee, we took this, the closure of these companies as a simple process. I think this is now that we understand that it has been a complex one. It was not as easy as one thought. And we've also observed that there were a lot of inconsistencies that happened through the processes and the misunderstandings between the National Treasury and the department. So I think those issues, we must make sure that though they don't happen in the future, the agreements or whatever, service level agreements or whatever proposals should be clear, and even the people from the National Treasury, I think we need to meet with them so that when they take these agreements from, or they approve these agreements from the department, they must ensure that everything is clarified. So I think as this committee, we still have a responsibility to meet with the National Treasury, because really everybody now finds itself being contributed to this mess. Now, we cannot just point fingers now to Belisa. We cannot demonize to Belisa. But I think previously the committee has been demonizing to Belisa. But today I think we have to come to a decision that to Belisa has not been a contributing factor only to this mess, what has happened. If we can go back to our AG's report, the special report that was commissioned by the department itself, it is clear the environmental assessments were not done, and those funds that were provided, they paid these assessment geotex. So you will find that there's a lot of inconsistency that happens. And another thing, there's a lot of asymmetric information here. We have been continuing with the other information, yet there's another information. So information was not coming, flowing as it is. It was just coming in bits and pieces. So you wouldn't be able to know exactly what is going on. We'll just take it as it is. So I think we request the department, when they come before the portfolio committee, they must ensure that at least, even their difficulties, they must just explain things as they are. Because the portfolio committee is there to advise. The portfolio committee is there to assist. When you are performing your oversight, it's not that you just point fingers. You are there to listen to the challenges. What are they? That are they? That are experienced by the department, so that we assist. So that those, for instance, I don't think the committee was aware of the defunct. You have been serving of the defunct board. Now today we are getting such things. So that is why I'm saying. Really, and I think even the department should take up the issue of the provinces that are reluctant to take those staff members, because we have heard that this is a concern from the committee. But they cannot take the projects, and then they don't take the staff. And we know that this government, the responsibility of this government, is to train, retrain our staff so that they are skilled. So you cannot just throw away people just because they don't have skills. If you think that they don't have skills, it is the responsibility of the government to ensure that the people of this country are skilled. So I think with those few words, Honorable, I'm tempted to say Honorable Jan. Whenever I see you, I just get tempted. Mr. Gandhi, as you are responsible, representing the office of the minister, and I've seen Mr. Lerumo, he has gone already.
Yeah.
So I think you will also assist us in conveying these messages to the minister, because Mr. Mbongwe is there to represent the DG. So we really appreciate your presence. Because it means your presence here is going to make our work very, very easier so that these things do not happen again. And we are going to visit that place. When we come back from our constituency in beginning of August, we are going to visit the N2 Gateway to assess, because we have been there, those issues that were raised by those protesters, we are aware as the portfolio committee. We have seen them. It's not that it's just coming out of the blue, but we have not yet observed what has been done, the work that has been done. So we're going to make sure that we visit that place. Okay, thank you very much. You are all... Okay, sorry. Can I... Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Iso Lambert Mopasa. I'm the chairperson of the trustees in Joburg. And I would love to answer the question. I don't know whether is it the right time to ask this question to be answered here, because if I can left to this community without asking this question, definitely that will
probably to put me in danger, then I will have to directly ask a friend. In this very same judgment, there's something that is stated there that must be the people of Chovdovo must be engaged with the Tumelija homes and as well as the lawyers. When are they going to engage with the people of Chovdovo with regard to this very same judgment? Because I know that the due date was yesterday, and now that today is the 8th, so I wanted to know when are they going to engage with the community of Chovdovo. And what I fail to understand as well, the date of the relocation is already highlighted on the 19th of October. How can that be? You know the date of relocating people, but you didn't first go to, you know the answer before you get to the meeting. That's what I fail to understand. I need an answer on that.
We are finding ourselves in an unfortunate situation because the problem here, we were not aware that the committee is here. But because the invitation was directed to Tumelija, so we took as if everybody is here. It's from Tumelija or the department or from the media people, communication within parliament. So I think this question, because we talk of participatory democracy, whereby the people who are involved should be taken care of. We cannot just take it and easy this question and then we just ignore. Because they are here now, we have to respond to that question. When is Tumelija going to consult in terms of the Joseph? No, Ndade, I know you're going to want to say let's not proceed with this. But this is a question that has been raised in the meeting. We are still going to come to those people, but it does not mean that we can just leave them as they are.
I'm not going to say that, but I want to say that.
Let's give them and the department to discuss this.
Mm.
And let us not be involved in this.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Suggestion that says,
yes.
Let's give that opportunity to the department,
yes,
to engage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No, I promise that we are going to be part of it. We are going to give that opportunity to the department to address this, and we are going to monitor the process if it is happening. And we are still going to meet with those people if they are not satisfied as the public representatives, because we have been elected by the people to look at their own challenges if they are not being attended. So if that thing is not attended, but you can see now there is a problem here that is raised. So we require the department and curator to take this matter very, very seriously. Let's put it there.
In addition to that, I wasn't sure if I'm having a capacity to just interfere during the discussion. However, I've just seen that there is a possibility that people can have a say. However, I'll, through your respect, I'll just comment on one thing or two. As the coordinator of the Chovdovo Task Team, my name is Mzwanele Zulu. I would love this new housing development agency to ensure that in whatever they are going to be doing in the development of this intended N2 gateway project, to ensure that they are meaningfully engaging with communities in the near future, to ensure that there are no disruptions in the development of housing. Because we are sitting here today discussing issues that we aren't supposed to be discussing. For example, development of housing in the N2 gateway project is not supposed to be sort of being delayed so much. Because of lack of transparency and lack of meaningful consultation with people, then we are here today. Then I would emphasize that we need to be a part of development. We need development to be done in situ where people that are marginalized are not being chased away in the outskirts of the cities. Because we've been disadvantaged during the apartheid system, and even now under democratic system, we are still disadvantaged. Therefore, we need that accessibility to resources, and we need to be part of development to empower people that are currently marginalized. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the input. This committee is taking you seriously. It's taking you seriously. That is why we are saying we are giving the opportunity, but I think we need to have a time frame. When we come back from the, because the house is we are leaving on Friday for the constituency period. So when we come back in August, we are giving the opportunity to the department to look at all issues that you are complaining about. And then when we come back, we'll make a follow-up with this portfolio committee. It's not that we are taking you very lightly, we are taking you very seriously. And we are committed as the portfolio committee to make a follow-up on those issues by the department. I wouldn't like you to respond to this because we have given you the opportunity to look at the issue. When we come back, we'll call you together with the committee now. We will call you together with the committee to express their challenges, and we are expecting that their challenges would have been addressed when we come back. At least 50% of them. More especially the consultation is not an issue. The issue of consultation, we cannot sit here and debate the issue of consultation because it is a constitutional requirement that people should be involved. So let's leave it on that way. When we come back, we meet you. The meeting adjourns. Members, we still have something just for 10 minutes. But I'm sorry, I think. Thank you very much, everybody.
Oh, sorry. I nearly
MC, your ex MC. Funny committee on Gucci.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
Just have your name and your posse. I don't have your name.
Okay. I'd like to use my second surname, but it's a DA, né? Democratic Alliance.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Toronto.
Thank you. My notebook is secure.
Oh.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Fine. You see, all the men are running away from you, and I'm still sitting here. I think I'd rather run.
This is official. Parliament has got an arrangement where we are supposed to be having a management committee that is going to run day-to-day activities of the committee. You know, sometimes it's difficult for the committee to meet. For instance, we are supposed to have to prepare our budget. We don't have a budget for the portfolio committee that has been prepared now. We need to prepare our budget for the financial year for the term. And then we also need to prepare the strategic plan of the committee itself. And those things, those issues, they need a special committee that has got to sit and deal with those issues before you call the bigger portfolio committee, so that you present those issues to the committee, and then you say they need to be a rectification. You know the day-to-day operation or management of the committee. So we are supposed to be having 7 members of the management committee. 4 are from the ruling party, in a sense that only 2 members that are appointed. The chairperson sits on the management committee. The whip also sits. So those 2 people are non-negotiable. And then from the side of the opposition parties, we need 3 people. So that is the situation that. So I would like to request the members to nominate, because we have to call special meetings now. Even sometimes we can call the management committee for the constituency period, because when we get back from the constituency period, we need to start running the program. So we cannot wait. We'll see. Because we are the people who are, I think we are all committed in this committee. You can even come for the week during the weekend, but if it's negotiable. So can we call for the nominations? We start from the first. In fact, let's just put these 2 people, the chairperson, the whip. Then we nominate the rest of the people. I'm calling for the nominations.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to check, are we starting with the opposition or are we...
Start by nominating the members from the or the ruling party.
Sorry. Before Chairperson, I just want to get a clarity. If this is on the agenda, why didn't I know about it? Why didn't we know about it? It is on the agenda. Okay.
No, don't worry.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
All right, thank you, Chairperson. I'm nominating Honorable J.M. Bowman. Thank you.
I was second. Yeah, no. A political thing. No.
Before I nominate a person, can I just find out if I can nominate a member who is not here? Okay. In that case, I nominate the name of Honorable Mudimele. Honorable Mudimele has been nominated by Comrade Asimoni, who is the seconder. Honorable Lamini. And then we come to the rest of the members. Honorable Fitland.
Thank you, Chair. Just trying to be faster.
Yeah.
Can I nominate Honorable Stang?
Honorable Stang. Seconded by Honorable Walter. Okay. The third nomination.
And Honorable Walter.
Honorable Walter.
Seconded.
Seconded by Comrade Asubone. Then the last one. Honorable Lamini. Honorable Lamini.
Seconded. By Lamini.
Thank you very much.
Seconded by Lamini.
thank you.
Thank you. Is the meeting adjourned? Oh.
I move for the adoption of the minutes.
And second it.
Thank you very much, Honorable. You are a listener.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your.
I nearly say the lady left us.
Okay.